today's News Talk Radio, TNT, with Joseph Arthur and his Technicolor Dreamcast.
Tucker Carlson tweeted, "News coverage in the West has become a tool of repression and control. There's only one solution to propaganda, telling the truth without fear." My next guest knows a lot about news coverage. He spent 50 years as news chief of WCBS, KCBS, a bunch of other letters and stuff. And so he's a longtime newsman. So we're going to go deep into what is going on with the news of the world today. But he's also a poet, and he's got 6 volumes of something called muscular poetry. And it's a word trip that requires no LSD, peyote to be read, or with good weed. It really is raw and lean, served up tough and chewy. No flowers and roses, sweet kisses, and all the other bull of other poets. Or as Kerouac would say, no time for poetry, just the facts. It reflects Bukowski, Fante, and the Beats, Ginsberg. Like I said, Kerouac, men of grit. So let's talk about grit. Steve, welcome to the show. What is grit, and how do we get it into our poetry?
It's great to be with you. You know, I think grit is life. I mean, that's what life's about. You know, life isn't easy. And I think what happens a lot for men particularly is that we're always in denial of that. You know, we're always trying to pull things together, make things right for others, and sort of lose sense of what we need and what we're about. So when I started writing poetry, it took me till I was in my 60s, by the way, to actually have the guts to sit down and write stuff that was true. I think there's a gap. I just don't think people speak to guys in words that have meaning to them. And that's why I call it muscular poetry. And it's poetry for guys. It's about the real stuff that we all have to deal with, not only relationships, but just who we are. You know, and I think that's damn important, you know, that whatever your art form is, you need to express it. And I guess my premise, Joe, is that all men are poets. You know, I think we're all poets. I think we all have something that runs through us that speaks to a larger frame of reference that we don't get in touch with. Now, guys like you who are, you know, who have some, you know, have keyboards and guitars and have great musical talent, that's your expression. But most of us aren't blessed with that. So we have to find other ways to express ourselves. And whether that's fixing your car or going on a hike or being a carpenter, I don't care what it is, there's poetry in that. And if you can just stop long enough and take a deep breath and say, you know, where am I going, man? Things get better.
Yeah, it's so funny. You know, this is a weird thing to bring up, but I couldn't sleep last night and I was watching, you know, YouTube, and there was a suggestion to watch Vanilla Ice on Steve-O's podcast, and I couldn't resist Vanilla Ice. And he's actually an interesting guy. And he was one of the things that struck me about the interview was he was saying poetry guides his life. He's like, it's all about poetry. And you know, from my generation, we would laugh off Vanilla Ice because of Ice Ice Baby, and you wouldn't think of him as somebody that would rate poetry to that degree. But he brought it up several times as poetry is something that guides his life. And I've been a poet my whole life. I've always written poetry. And as he was saying that, I was like thinking, man, I need to honor poetry more. So go figure. But Vanilla Ice inspired me. And now our conversation to rate poetry as more important, you know.
Yeah, think about, you know, when you think about any of the creative arts and people that we all love. I was, you know, you were with Vanilla Ice last night, and I was with Axl Rose of all the people. But I just love "Sweet Child of Mine" because when you, besides the performance and the guitar lick was just like, you know, insane. It's one of the great guitar licks of all time.
Definitely.
But the words just get you. I mean, you know, what is "Great Child of Mine" all about? It's about love. It's about reaching out and touching. Mm-hmm. And of course, Axl brings it in a specific way that's powerful. Or then you look at hard rock and you look at Metallica, right? One of the great bands of all time. And "Nothing Else Matters," right? And you look at that song, which is also a tone poem. Now, again, you know, it's another great piece of music, great guitar, etc. But the but what gets the audience, besides the beat and the vibe of it, you can't get away from the message, right? And really, when you look at pop culture today, the message has always been there. The message reaches us across genre, whether it's hard rock like Metallica or whether it's Frank Sinatra, right? You know, I'm going to do it my way is Sinatra's poetry, right? George mm-hmm. Gershwin's got Rhapsody in Blue. And you look at, and of course, Taylor Swift, right? Today's true poet of the trauma of relationships, right? I mean, if you look at Taylor Swift, why is she popular? Because she's talking to an enormous amount of people that feel that whatever it is, that simple thing of man-woman just always seems to go wrong, right? And when Taylor Swift's new album is all about everything going wrong, right? I mean, she never writes a song about, I fell in love, this was great, me and Kelsey are cool. It's always about the traumatic circumstances that surround relationships. I think poetry has a way of just breaking through that. Also, the Greek, and I know since you write poetry, you know this. The beauty of poetry is that you don't have to be a novelist, right? You can live with your idea, get your thought expressed, and go on to the next thought. Well, if you're writing, I've written a bunch of novels too. Nothing's harder than writing a novel because there you've got to come up with an enormous amount of illumination before you're able to, you know, create whatever it is you're going to create. Poetry is a short form to reach our soul. And I think that's why it's so ubiquitous. I mean, there's no place you can go where poetry is not right there in front of you, whether it's on your radio, Netflix, whatever, it's sort of there. Hey, I'm doing a monologue here, Joe. I don't want to do a monologue, but once I get going, you can see I just love to talk about it.
I love it, man. I mean, but when I was growing up, you know, the Beats, it's in your bio, a lot of these beat guys, yeah. Ginsberg, Bukowski. I mean, Bukowski wasn't really a beat, but he kind of was. He was a cousin. Yeah. He was like the dirty cousin of the Beats.
Yeah, exactly right.
Burroughs, yeah. You know, and those guys, and even Fonte, I mean, because Bukowski talked about Fonte and, yeah. You know, and all these people, they were our heroes, man. We didn't have social media. There was no internet. It was like sports. And then to get artistic, it was these poetry guys that came sort of through rock and roll as well. And that was it. I mean, we all had aspirations of being great writers. And like, we would read every single Charles Bukowski book and trade them yeah. and, you know, and, go ahead.
I think that one of the powers of those guys, one, they were just regular guys. Okay. They were not shirt and tie guys. They were just guys like you and me, you know, grew up in whatever humble beginnings, sort of found ourselves. And these guys had those types of lives. Right. And also in their own way, they were speaking what we use as a cliche of truth to power. Right. They were saying, look, here's our truth, and that truth may sync up with the way world's working or not. If it's the Beats, it's against the Eisenhower Nixon administrations, right? If it's Bukowski, you're sort of stuck in the you're sort of in the 60s, 70s with him, although he lives later than that. And today, the poetry that's written is just too politically correct for my taste, right? It's just too much about one side of the aisle in terms of thought. And that's one of the other reasons I started writing. It just bothered me that you couldn't write about traditional American values, traditional guy values in a way that was raw and that didn't need to be put through a political sieve to make it come out correct. I mean, like when you look at who are our poet laureates today, our poet laureates are all folks that are from a left of center philosophy. And again, I'm not critiquing that. I'm just saying I don't prefer it, right? I'm not that interested in DEI and the other inflections of thought right now. That I either, if I don't embrace those inflections, you know, I'm sort of pilloried. So it's harder to speak truth to power these days because the power is ubiquitous. Especially, you know, like you started talking to me about, I'm a media guy, you know, And media day is filled with that sort of sense of there's one way to think, one way to talk, one way things that we celebrate and observe and other things that don't. And God forbid if you're on the outside of that, you know, like the hippies were in the late 60s, you know, you're canceled, man. And
well, that was true. I think there's lots of voices of resistance rising up. I mean, the sort of alternative media is gaining lots of traction, and there are people speaking out against wokeism. I'm not really too familiar with who the modern poet laureates are. I mean, if it's anything like the music industry, yeah, it's harder, I guess. It's not harder to speak truth, but it's maybe harder to get your voice out there if the publishing houses won't publish, you know, sort of alternative views, I guess.
Yeah, I think that the Ferlinghetti's and the Bukowski's and the Kerouac's would be very challenged in today's environment. I think it's a very tough environment. I think of Jack Kerouac, you know, taking a roll of paper, right, basically brown wrapping paper, and sitting in a typewriter,
writing on the road,
and typing out on the road, you know, and it's all on one scroll, and you go.
You know what Truman Capote said about on the road?
No, what?
He said that's not writing, that's typing. He was threatened. One of the great all time put down. I mean, obviously it's not true. On the Road is a masterpiece, but yeah. it's an incredible put down. You got to give me credit for it.
I love that you bring that up, because it's that effetism, that elitism of what is art and what isn't art. And, you know, you look at the Andy Warhol era, you know, and you say, well, that's that pop art sort of changed things, right? And you look at graffiti art, which became true art, you know, art forms, like some of the stuff that's behind you sort of has that feel for it. So it seems to me that is that yours? Cool.
Yeah.
So you know, and I see influences there, right? Do you have somebody that comes off the top of your head, an influencer of your work?
Oh, Basquiat. I'm into de Kooning. I'm into Rauschenberg, Jasper Johns, those old school painting heroes, Pollock.
Right.
You know.
Right, but in a sense, they were using oil and acrylic as their vehicle for the expression of what we're talking about in poetry, right? I mean, there's no difference there. I mean, they like Basquiat, very reflective of his time, right? Very much so, and he's using all of the tools of the street to tell his story,
and words and poetry. He was a poet as well.
As well, right? But so you know, you look at those. Like, one of my favorite abstract artists is Cy Twombly.
And I love Cy Twombly, dude. One of my favorites.
So you look at Twombly's work, and it's so eclectic. It's, you know, it blows your mind, because he's got regular art on it. He's got words scribbled across the canvas.
That's incredible,
right? So you sort of feel this need to be explosively expressive, that Twombly, that's why I love his work. It's this explosive expressionism that just, boom, he gets it on the canvas.
Yeah.
You know, that's why he was great, right?
I took mushrooms one time and went to the MoMA in New York, and it was a big Cy Twombly sort of retrospective going on, and I was trapped there for like 5 hours.
Was it bad mushrooms? It was bad mushrooms, I guess, right? No,
it was incredible. But, you know, now there's a whole theory that, like, a lot of that sort of modern expressionist painting was like a CIA op to make us like ugly things. Mm-hmm. I don't see it that way, because I love it. It resonates with my soul. But have you heard tell of that?
Yeah, I have. But I think, you know, there are a lot of conspiracy theories, and every theory gets visibility today because of the internet, right? In the old days, your crazy Uncle Joe would say that to you at dinner, and you say, "Joe, you're crazy, leave me alone." Now Uncle Joe has, you know, 12,000 followers. So I don't put much credence into that, but I do think that there is a essential human quality that makes us artists, that makes us want. And if art's to a feat for your audience, let's just call it creativity, right? There's something about us as Homo sapiens that makes us artists. And how do we know that? Well, they used to think that it was just the Neanderthal guys in the caves of Europe that were, you know, etching beautiful things on the caves 100,000 years ago. Just two or three weeks ago, they found etchings that they think were back to Homo sapiens sapiens, which is about 200,000 years ago, art on walls. So, you know, go back to the beginning of who we were as sentient beings, which is Homo sapiens sapiens 200,000 years ago. Go to 50,000, you've got a lot of art. And now you go to today and you see this explosion. I think what is problematic for me is that art in all of its iterations seems to be a secondary characteristic that government funds, that schools want to hold on to. That's art, music, dance, it's you name it. And it's not secondary. It's as important as geometry, calculus, and all the other crap they teach us in school. You know, I don't think that art should be considered a secondary function of the human spirit. I think it's the primary driver of who we are as humans. Agree? Not
true expression is threatening to compliance. That's for sure. I mean, they get at us by eliminating God in our lives. And even someone like Charles Bukowski would always talk about capturing the magic, you know? So if you think about that, what does that mean? That means a divine connection. And he would use simple language and talk about sort of rough street stuff, getting drunk, fights, all that. And there would be this turn of magic in his work that was profound and surprising, and just using real basic block-like words. It's really kind of incredible. But that makes us harder to control. If we have that connection with the divine, we're not able to sort of be controlled then.
Right, but I also think that certainly in Bukowski's work, he took what seemingly was the mundane and turned it into things that were ethereal. And the reason he could do that is because that's the way life really is. In other words, the stuff you do today that you think doesn't mean anything, guess what? It means a lot. And the hard part is, do you have the ability to be awake to get that, right? And I always say, when I say that, folks that I'm talking to, I say, look, the life we are in modern society is sort of a staccato life, right? So it's staccato. The unfortunate thing is, as humans, we're legato, right? So we're having to be forced into this staccato, boom, 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 boom life. It doesn't give us a lot of chance to pause, think, reflect, and grow.
It's a staccato life. We're legato beings, and they're trying to change us all into Mr. Roboto.
Nicely done.
Remember, right? There we go. Let me take a quick break. We'll be right back with an amazing guy, Steve Cohen. He's a poet, muscular poetry, right after these words on TNT.
TNT. Sonia Poulton.
They were talking about the new report that a generation of children will fail at school and in exams as a consequence of lockdown. Susanna said, "I feel we failed our children." And the others nodded in unison. But no, wait a minute, Susanna. We did not fail our children. We, i.e. people like me, we campaigned and protested. We petitioned, we shouted, we podcasted. We made endless social media posts. And we said very, very loudly and repeatedly that we are deeply, deeply concerned with the lockdown measures being applied to everyone, including children. And you, Miss Reed, and the rest of Legacy Media just kept ramping up the pressure day in and day out.
Sonia Poulton on today's News Talk, TNT. TNT is an independent global news talk station that does what others only say they do. TNT is a live radio and TV broadcaster that simply tells the truth 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. No one in the world does what we do, crisscrossing the globe, providing credible news and opinion all day and all night. In 2.5 years, TNT has become a credible and exciting platform with brilliant hosts and staff. It's a critical time, and we must continue to call out the misinformation and propaganda from mainstream media and their powerful sponsors. We're now appealing to our many friends and supporters around the world to go to tntradio.live and make a small donation to TNT while we seek the right investors to continue our important mission. We don't rock. We talk. Today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
And we rock. And we talk. Life is what happens when you make other plans, famously sung John Lennon. I'm far from where I thought I'd be. Life happened while I made other plans. Steve Cohen's going to read us a poem called Far From Where You Thought You'd Be. Take it away, Steve.
Thank you, Joe. Far from where you thought you'd be. In bedrooms, young men lie awake, staring at ceilings as though they are screens, where a future is projected that can be the source of all their dreams. Shadows mostly appear. Clarity is lost in the vagaries of the daily grind, attempting to just manage life, avoid being stabbed in the night by an unexpected fate, staying up late to contemplate a vision within or without somewhere. It's obvious to the fortunate just what they should become: natural skills, ability, or an inner drive that cannot be overcome. You make a pact that you'll be that guy who does what he imagines, plays a horn, drives a truck, cuts open chests, butchers chickens, wears a badge, conquers cancer, perfects an electric car, runs for something special, and spends your life in its pursuit. Falls in love, maybe, just enough to get laid or married or have progeny. Progeny who may actually talk to you as you fade from energetic tough guy to a forgotten man of some advancing age. In that bed, what do you see on that ceiling in your room? Was it a grand display for you in a starring role when you were handsome, self-assured, and ready to take on the leading role? Did any of it come to pass before the forces broke you down? Did you have any chance at all at making it on the town? Where did those big dreams go? Unrealized, achieved, and lost. Impossible to hold. Impermanence stalks the future, destroying certainty and peace of mind. Ultimately leaving you only with the dreams again, projected on that bedroom wall that lets you sleep some nights, unafraid of what's next.
Man,
so that's a sample.
I feel like you've been reading my mind or something, reading my life, Steve. That was brilliant. I got chills several times during that, and it's awesome, man. There's a lot to break down in that. As a man, it resonates so fully to me. We're all like battling ourselves all the time to do what we want to do in this life, or what we know we have the potential to do. And we oscillate between sometimes being on it and other times letting ourselves weigh down.
Yeah. And the hard part is, how do you overcome that if you want to, right? Because as I say in that poem, all these things that we think we're going to be, and sometimes we are some of those things, but ultimately there's always something left behind, I think, right? That there's always something more of us if we can but find it. And the hard part, and that's why I love that poem, how many times do I just lie awake at night looking at the ceiling, hoping for some movie to start that's about where I want to be, and sometimes you're lying with somebody that you care about, right? And she's on to her dream, and where are you, man? You've taken care of her and the kids and everybody else. So I think there's that's sort of where I am as a poet, is that there's this interlocking complexity that goes on that I live in a place called Pacific Beach, which is in San Diego. And I live, I'm like the oldest guy. Everybody else is young. And I see all these young guys, struggling with trying to figure that all out. And you've got to, I think, pause in order to figure it out. And I know in my own life, I wasn't pausing for a whole bunch of decades, man. I was just, moving as hard as I could to realize what I thought was my influence. That's why I write in there, what I call master of the universe. There's a period where most of us feel we're MOUs, right? We've got the universe under control. We got it. We're on our vibe. And Some guys are lucky enough to have that for a long time. Most of us have it for a little bit, and then it goes away, and sometimes it comes back. And then the forces come. And Bukowski talked a lot about that, right? It's that sort of sense of, well, you're living your life, and then the forces come. And it isn't a goddamn thing you're going to do about the forces coming. There's this wave coming. You can decide to swim up against it, or you can decide to get on your board and try to ride it in the shore and not get destroyed. And depending on that choice, life gets easier, life gets hard. And most of us, I think, spend time in our little boats blowing wind into the sails to give us direction instead of letting the wind come and take the boat wherever the boat's going to go, right?
That's so interesting. I think about that all the time. Like the concept of free will on the sort of Christian side of things, of ourselves, we can do nothing. It's all about grace and mercy. It's all about the will of God. And it's us like sort of surrendering to that. And then, you know, the other day I was watching Mike Tyson interviewed by Patrick Bet David, and you're looking at Mike Tyson, who's gone through a lot of his own spiritual journey, and somebody asked him about manifestation, and he was saying how he imagined himself, it was all about self-belief, and he's a believer in God too, but it was the sort of more the self-empowered manifestation, envisioning yourself as like, which is it we're manifesting our reality, or our reality is dictated by God that we have to surrender to? Do you believe in free will, or do you believe that's an illusion?
I think it's all an illusion. I think that's sort of ultimately the reality of our consciousness, is that there is a consciousness, and depending on, you know, which philosophical guy, if you want to believe in Carl Jung, there's a sort of a collective consciousness that we're all in touch with that sort of has its own beat and realm. If you believe in, like, one of my favorite guys is Sidney Banks. Sid Banks was a Scotch welder in the 1930s, lived into the 1990s, and he was a welder, and life was crazy. And then he developed this idea of these aspects of life. And here's what Sid said, and you should look up on his website. Sid Banks passed away now, but Sid said this. Look, here's the way it works. You have a mind. That mind has a consciousness, right? What you're talking about. There's a consciousness. And that consciousness creates something as simple called thoughts. Now, you're in control of your thoughts. That's where your free will comes. You can decide
you
to have so? One thought or another
you think
thought.
You think you control your thoughts?
Well, I think you can control.
Right? I don't know about that.
Well, let me finish. So you have your thoughts, and your thoughts create a feeling, right? All thoughts do are create a feeling. And then if you get enough feelings together from those thoughts, you take action. That's what happens, right? You have a thought, you have a feeling, you take action. Mm. You're not going to take action unless a thought or a feeling did it. You don't just take action out of nowhere, do you? Or maybe you do.
Well, listen, I don't think you control your thoughts. I think you observe your thoughts. You can observe your thoughts and decide which ones to pay attention to, but thoughts run themselves.
But do you think, Joe, that you're one thought away from where you want to be? So like if you're in a down place or you're making yourself crazy, all you have to do is choose another thought to get out of it, right? That's all you have to do.
Yeah.
So why don't we do that?
I see what you're saying. Well, I think our battle is with principalities. And so when it says, you know, our battle's not with flesh and blood, but with principalities, principalities exist where? They exist in our thoughts. So yeah. I do believe in sort of demonic influence, and I believe they manifest through thoughts. So my only power isn't the thoughts that roll through my head. They're on their own. But if I decide to be present, then I can observe them through metacognition and sort of be the observer of my thoughts, and that's where my own will comes in.
Right, but the hard part is to be awake enough to make that choice, right? Just what you said requires a series of gateways that you have to go through so that you can get to the cognition that you're after, right? You can't get to that metacognition unless you've said, I'm awake enough to get there. Because if you're so overwhelmed by whatever thoughts are going through your mind, making you crazy, isn't it really hard to transit over to the
100%. then you're identifying as your thoughts. If you're identifying as your thoughts, you are lost. You are in the devil's grasp for sure. If you're taking one level up and being the observer of thoughts, which is what metacognition is, which is what humans can do, then you know you're not your thoughts. So I would say, I know I'm not my thoughts, yet my thoughts are still just going to run. And then by observing them, I'm inviting the light of God in, and then he can give me revelations, which can then guide my life. That's the way it is in my three-pound universe.
Here's a question for you. But is the light of God a continual source for you, or instead is the spark of the Lord inside of you, and that there really is no external light there? Instead, the light is inside of you, and all you're really doing is reaching into your own essence in order to get to the spot that you want to be cognitively.
To me, God is present and always present. So if I'm in my thoughts, I'm identifying with the past and the future, and I'm full of regret and anxiety. Yeah. But if I'm present then, and I'm observing my thoughts, then the light of God is resonating constantly. It's consciousness itself. Neville Goddard talks about that it's the voice of God is the human imagination.
Yeah, and I think when you look at Neville, sort of one of the real beginning guys of positive psychology, right? I mean, when he was giving his lectures in the 40s, he was really sort of at the top list of guys that were doing it. He's sort of been forgotten, by the way, except to you and me. I don't know anybody else who talks about Neville Goddard. Do you?
No, but he's on my YouTube algorithm along with Vanilla Ice, so I see him all the time.
So a side point on Neville, just because it's just sort of a fun story. You know, he says that he came across the black Ethiopian Jew, Abdullah, the black Ethiopian Jew who he met walking down a street in Manhattan, who told him what was going to happen to his life. It is, and it's true that a black Ethiopian Jew named Abdullah did exist and actually advised a number of very well-known people on earth at the time. So Neville felt that he got a divine spark from Abdullah, and Abdullah opened the door to him to what we know he did, which is positive psychology, and you can find this stuff within you. But what I'm suggesting is that whatever the creative force was that made where we are and made the cosmos, and I don't know whether that's one force or a million, who knows how many forces it is. I think that light exists within all of us as humans. That in other words, it's sort of like God said, you're all going to have this spark forever and ever, as long as you're a species, as you spark. I'm gone. I got other stuff to do. Right. That's what the deists believe. Like Thomas Jefferson thought, well, yeah, they used to call him a clockmaker. There's a guy that's going to make the clock. He made all of us. And then he said, good, here's the clock. You guys figure it out. And that's where the social contract, Rousseau and Locke and all those, and our constitution, all that came out of the sense that we were given divine providence, and then the divine left the building.
Interesting. Yeah. It's super. I think the human predicament is so fascinating that we do have these dual natures, that, you know, the devil is real and God is real, and that within us both exist, and they're fighting for dominance. And most people seem to be losing the battle.
So here's what I don't get. So we've been around, as I said, for about 200,000 years as a species, and the last 50,000 being who we are today, right? We look and sound like guys would 50,000 years ago. How is it that in those 50,000 years, the nature of Homo sapiens sapiens doesn't seem to have changed at all? Are we kinder, gentler, more forgiving, more open, or are we still as capable of the horrors of October 7th, what's going on in Gaza, you name it, right?
Right.
So take your theology, if you will, and explain to me, how is it that human nature hasn't evolved? We've evolved physically, of course, but in terms of our human nature, what's up with that?
That's beyond my capacity, my friend. That would be something for a poem to try to tell me. But I have not cracked the code at all. I don't even know if we have free will or not. I'm up for any conversation along those lines as well. I don't really know. The first question, what's the first thing you would say to God if you get to meet him? I would say, what's up? What was up with that? What was the,
yeah, I would say like
what,
hey man.
I would be like, what was up with that? Thanks for the ride, but what was up with that?
You didn't need the serpent in the Garden of Eden, right? I mean, you could have left out the serpent. So why not leave that out, God? Give me a break.
I want to talk about the serpent in the Garden of Eden, because I know you talk about the nature of man and what manhood means. And I definitely want to hear another poem. I actually want to talk to you for like 3 more hours, man, because this is fun. But the Garden of Eden is interesting. Go ahead.
Yeah, I got a poem for you. I got a poem so far away from whoever you really are.
So okay, good. All right, hold on. We're going to get to that right after the break, but and also the Garden of Eden, where it all went horribly wrong, or it all went upside down. I wonder what you think of the biblical order, Christ over man, man over woman, woman over child, and all that, and how far we've gone from that as a reality. But let me take a quick break. We're going to get another poem from the fascinating Steve Cohen right after these words on TNT.
Thank you, Joe.
When a crisis hits, close to home and across the globe, nonprofits are on the front lines, ready to serve.
Keep coming.
The demand for charitable services has skyrocketed, and nonprofits are rising to meet the needs. Healing. Nurturing. Rescuing. Honoring. Protecting. Caring. Inspiring. The work of philanthropic organizations of all sizes, across all missions, has never been more important. And it's donors and volunteers like you who make all this possible. Thank you. Together, we change the world. The Nonprofit Alliance.
Internet crimes against children in New Mexico are real. And when it comes to protecting your children, the New Mexico AG's office and the ICAC unit are on the front lines. I'm New Mexico Attorney General Hector Balderas. There's nowhere to hide for online predators in New Mexico. We are working tirelessly using state-of-the-art technology and resources to seek out and find them wherever they are. Please talk to your children about the dangers that exist online. Social media, games, and messenger apps. It's always important to know who you're talking to.
Help fight online predators in New Mexico by submitting a tip today.
Joseph Arthur and his Technicolor Dreamcast on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Talking with longtime newsman and poet Steve Cohen. He's got another poem for us called So Far. What's it called, Steve? So Far From Where You Really, Who You Really Are?
Yeah, so far away from whoever you really are. Let me read it to you, see what you think of it. Some guys always have it, a certain point of view, a knowing that runs through them of who they really are. Men with inherent talents, unlocked, can never be contained. Polymaths, inventors, musicians, sculptors, you know them all by name. Da Vinci, Edison, Schweitzer, Einstein, Dizzy and the Duke, Michelangelo, and even Johnny Cash. There never was any question who they would be, driven or just emerging, an essence unsuppressed. Whatever else they were as men, flawed and tortured by life's warp and woof, frailty forgotten, contributions were made. Unambiguous existence, unlike those without an obvious searing purpose. Expecting to bump into it, waiting for a Flying Dutchman and fries at the Cabazon In and Out. When was the last time you felt like yourself, if you can remember that far back? Walked with shoulders high on a confident, straight back. Had an easy smile and laughed in intervals. and not bad jokes, but at life. Looked towards an undetermined future and had no fears at all. Confidence defined you, and you never worried that you'd fall. Thought you actually could be anything you wanted to become if you could just imagine the outcome. Then the forces come to get you. Real life shows up. You're a piece in a vast jigsaw puzzle on grandmom's dining room table, and the image that's created just came out of the wrong box. Can't play a violin. Sing any note on key. Build a damn thing. Repair a damaged heart. Design a work of art. Or find the energy to play any other part. Is that boy still there? Lean, strong, and tall, who saw only possibilities? Is he still there anywhere at all?
Beautiful. It resonates with the last poem you wrote. Is this a very personal tale for you? I mean, you're quite an accomplished guy, but you said you kind of discovered poetry later in life, although not too late. And plus, you still seem as young as anyone I've ever met, really.
I think this must be a recurring theme.
Is what I'm getting at.
Yeah, well, I read you two that sort of hung together. There are, you know, my poetry is like all over the place in terms of the, you know, themes. I write about everything, but this is my favorite topic of my poetry, which is the evolvement of self as a man and how you find yourself or don't, and how most of us are always trying to balance who we want to be if we can find ourselves, and not in life thinking that we never got a shot at it.
It's so refreshing, because what we do get is these reflections of the Mike Tysons, and I'm going to bring them up again. Even Vanilla Ice was talking about all his success and how great his life is going, and then we get these reflections of these men who are like the ones you listed off there, that, you know, and that we know they've had hardships, and they sort of cursorily speak on their hardships while they talk about all their accomplishments. So your poetry is very comforting for most of us who are struggling and striving.
Yeah, I also think that we have a reality is that we all have artistic and creative ability, you know, things that aren't there and that are there after we touch them. That's what creativity is. It's that simple, right? I look at a blank page, and then a few minutes later, there's something there. I created something. And I always say to guys, as I'm talking to guys, lecturing and just being with people, it takes as much effort and time to create crap as it does to create something that's transcendent. You know, I want to be Hemingway. I'm not. I'm still going to write. I want to be Bukowski. I'm not. I still want to be a poet. And that's sort of what we have to come to as modern men. Stop judging. Stop stopping yourself. Stop closing the gate on your life. Open the goddamn gate. Who the hell cares if it's not good? It's this judgment that we put on stuff as guys that keeps us from the creative realization of who we are. And as you
how
say,
do you do it? How do you do it? How do you get past that internal judgment? And how often are you sidetracked by it?
Well, a lot. I mean, I think most, you know, the truth is that for most of us who have to make a living doing other things, there is a spasm of creativity that you get in between everything else that's happening in life. And what you try to do is elongate that time when you're in the creative flow, right? And I think that's the trick. The trick is to say, I can't be in this all the time, but I have a responsibility to myself to find an opportunity to be in creative flow, whether that's pitching in a softball game or painting. If you don't put it into your life, it's not going to be in your life. And when I ask, I do an exercise with guys when I do lectures to guys. I said, draw a circle on a yellow pad and put into that circle what your day is like. Okay. And everybody puts in work and, you know, all that other stuff. And then I say, okay, is there a sliver in there for your creativity? And invariably everybody holds up their pad. There's no creativity in their circle of the day, and therefore in their circle of life. So, well, you're not going to get there, man, unless you put that in there. Now, if you have artistic ability, like you're an artist, you're a musician, whatever, that's in there. Like, so for my day, it took me till my 60s, but I started to put in, right. God damn it, right. If it sucks, it sucks. I don't care. Just do it. Because by doing it, you're expressing something that is inside of you that sets you free, at least for the time you're doing it. And that sense of setting yourself free through the act of creation, guess what? That's what we're all about as humans.
It takes discipline. It's like, you know, I have a daughter that I, you know, raise up half the time. And so a lot of my time is just hanging out with a 2.5-year-old, you know, but yeah. I recently started making myself wake up at 4:30 in the morning, although I've been off of that for like, you know, I sort of got sidetracked from my discipline, but I was for a solid month waking up at 4:30 in the morning and writing for the first 3 hours of the day. And, you know, you can eke out the time, even if your life is busy with lots of other things. You just have to become ultra disciplined about it. I mean, and that's the sort of, that's the balance. It's like getting on your own side enough to where the negative voices that allow you to keep sort of letting yourself down or off the hook become eliminated and you get on the right side. Or Stephen Pressfield talks about it in The War of Art, overcoming resistance and becoming a professional.
Right. And I think the hardest part of getting into the flow, into creative flow, is the decision that he's talking about, which is to do it. You've got it. You have to make a determined decision to get to jump into the flow. The hard part of flow is not when you're in it. It's getting to it. Right.
Oh yeah.
The creative experience is fulfilling. You know that once you're in it, and that's where the flow comes. The hard part is how do I get from life to into my flow? And unfortunately, you have to have what we call discipline, where you've got to plan it out. But I think the reason you get discipline is because you realize that this is a priority for your life going forward. You will become an enhanced, evolved, and better person because you open the door to being in creative flow. If you don't want to get into creative flow, you're living a life that is of your choice, but it's a much, much more narrow, defined life than you could have, because you don't really know if you could be the great carpenter that's going to make the next great cabinet, or the guy that makes the next Billy Joel song happen. My hell, you know, I'm always interested in how people who are great artists figure out that they're going to be great artists. And guess what? They don't figure it out. It just happens, right? Mm-hmm. It happens because they decided to do it. And in the doing, the revelation of creativity happens. So the hard part is implementation of the dream. It's not that we don't all dream. It's not that we don't all have things that we think we could do. It's how do you get to the implementation? And that's another show, man, because that's really hard. You know, that it takes time to figure that out.
Yeah, it is. It's a big conversation, but I'm much more aware. I'm much more keenly aware. I used to, like, you know, I made tons of albums and was my life revolved around creativity. And I would stay up deep into the night and make albums like till 5 a.m. and all this. And the older I get, and the more like you speak about in your poetry, the waves of life come at you, the more I'm aware that, if I sin in my life, if I fall off the path, if I engage in self-destructive behavior, it becomes nearly impossible for me to be disciplined enough to create now. Now it's very linked to me living a life according to sort of, in my view, sort of Christian values, or values where I'm not sinning and I'm not, where I'm like aligned with God. Then that flow state is so much easier for me to get to, because I love myself enough, because discipline is self-love, basically. So I love myself enough to engage in discipline that will get up at 4 a.m. and start writing and do that and feel engaged. And there's nothing that feels more fulfilling than that. That's the best feeling in the world.
Right, but it comes from a place that I think is foundational across all faiths. You know, the foundational elements of faiths are pretty much the same.
Right.
And there's a reason for it, because that's what puts us on a righteous path, as the Buddhist would say.
Oh, yeah.
And just
to interject real quick, I don't mean to say only Christian people could do that. I'm just saying that's how I identify with it. But yeah, I agree with you. Any faith where you know you're on your path. Yeah.
Yeah. But I think the righteous path is not as narrow as people who aren't about it think. I mean, it's sort of the fundamentals of living a good life. is where the righteous path is. Now, you can decide to have a leap of faith. Like if you're a Muslim, you can believe that Muhammad got on a winged horse named Barak, took it to the Temple of the Mount, and in one night ascended seven levels of heaven and sat with Allah. You know, that's a leap of faith, okay? And again, I'm not critiquing it. I'm saying, but there's every religion has a leap of faith. Christianity has the largest leap of faith of all, that Jesus was the Son of God. He lived, he died for all of us, and then he has risen. Well, that's as big a leap of faith as any other mystique. Or another leap of faith is one of my favorites for the Mormons, is that there's an angel Moroni who etches out on gold tablets the Book of Mormon, buries it in Western New York. Joel Smith finds it in the 1820s. Well, that's a leap of faith, right? That there's an angel Moroni, there was a Book of Mormon, and Joe Smith found it. Judaism, I mean, was there a Moses and Aaron? Nobody knows, you know? So, but the point isn't that that you have to make a leap of faith. The point is, what was the faith about? And the faith is about what you're talking about, is righteous being. And righteous being is the pathway to creativity, right?
Where do you think that moral, I feel a moral urging inside of your work in terms of you wanting to honor your potential and the gift that this life has presented to you. I think that's where that comes from. I think if this was a godless universe, we wouldn't feel that we were sort of letting a gift down. You know, when you speak of staring up at the ceiling and contemplating life and realizing that it could be more, or you could be doing more, that urge that it could be more, that you have something to express and something to offer. Where does that come from, do you think?
Well, for me, it comes from sort of a very time-honored concept of my faith. I'm a Jew. It's called Tikkun Olam, which means repair the world. In other words, the mythology that comes out of that is that when God created the world, he didn't do it perfectly, and we're all broken. And the job of you existing as a Jew in the world is repair the world. That means repair yourself, be better, help your family. Wherever you see trouble, try to repair it. In the Asian world, it's called kintsugi, where they take cracked ceramics and repair it with gold paste, right? So it's that idea that we're all broken, and the only way you get out of being broken is being a better self. If I can encourage every guy that I write about to become better, become more creative, I think creativity is a pathway to a better soul. And that's where it comes from. That's my philosophy. It's that simple. If you're creative, you got a shot at having a better soul. Guys with better souls are better men. Better men make better worlds. And that's where I come from.
And do you think you can make yourself better, or do you think that has to be a gift of you aligning yourself with God, or do you think it's you can do that of yourself?
Yeah, I do. I don't think I need anybody else around me to help.
You
me.
Do, Steve. Come on.
I'm good enough at screwing up my life. Hey, look, I screwed up my life all by myself. I ought to be able to repair it all by myself.
According to my faith, that was demonic that you screwed up your life. You listened to demons and demons screwed up your life. You didn't do it. You didn't do it.
I don't think any demons want to be in my old body anymore. So I think maybe I'm getting to a place where I'm going to be free, Joe.
Hey, man, we have like 2 minutes left. Can you read a quick one to take us out?
I don't have any quick ones.
No,
everything
quick
I
ones.
Read, unfortunately, is too goddamn long to...
Okay, let's talk about Allen Ginsberg for a second, because he's a fascinating character to me, and he is a good example of what you're talking about, the creative muse and stuff. He would write a lot of what I interpret as like subpar poetry, and a lot of it is in his collective works. And then he would have poems like Howl and Kaddish, which are just like over the top amazing, right? So like it's about like it's that thing you're talking about. Just get in and do it. Don't judge. And he, I think, exemplifies that, because a lot of his stuff is just like, whatever. And then Howl comes out and Kaddish comes out and you're like, wow.
Yeah, but his roots actually are somewhat similar to mine. I mean, I think he's got sort of a post-World War II mentality coming out of the traumatic period of World War II and the Depression. So if you're a child of the Great Generation, or you're part of the Great Generation, that concept that you just described really is there. But again, right. What I think he had is that he went for it, man. And that's the beauty of it.
Just go for it. That's Steve Cohen's message. I'm sorry if I put that in your mouth, but you know what I mean. Steve, tell everybody where to find you. And thank you so much. What an honor.
Well, the easiest place to find my poetry is called Muscular Poetry. And I'd say go get some of that. I think you'd enjoy it.
I'm going to get it. I think Kimberly actually sent me some books, so I'm looking forward to it. Thanks for coming on, man. I hope you enjoyed it. And I hope you'll come on again. All right, everybody.
Thank you.
Talk again, definitely. Keep listening to TNT, everybody. Have a great weekend. Bye-bye.